From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Democratic National Committee, ahead of its convention, puzzlingly dropped its goal to end subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, even as the party has claimed it acknowledges the seriousness of climate change. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has endorsed Representative Joe Kennedy in his bid to unseat Democratic Senator Ed Markey, the co-sponsor of the Green New Deal, in another indication that establishment Democrats seem to be paying only lip service to climate justice. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee has refused to even draft or vote on a party platform, preferring instead to throw its weight behind Trump's so-called America First policies that include artificially propping up the fossil fuel industry. We turn now to Antonia Juhas. She's an energy analyst, investigative journalist, and author specializing in oil politics. She's currently a Bertha Fellow in investigative journalism, working with a global team of journalists on fossil fuels and the climate crisis. She's written for Rolling Stone, Newsweek, Harper's Magazine, The Nation, Ms. Magazine, The New York Times, Pacific Standard, and is the author of three books, most recently Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Her latest article in Sierra magazine is called The End of Oil is Near. The pandemic may send the petroleum industry to its grave. Welcome to the program, Antonia.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Before we get to specifically what your article addresses, let's talk about the convention specifically. Of course, the Democratic National Convention that just ended. There was not that much focus on the climate crisis during the convention. And then, of course, ahead of the convention, as I mentioned, the DNC dropped its opposition to fossil fuel subsidies. Why do you think this happened and how significant is it?
Well, I will say, you know, there was basically one day of solid policy in the DNC convention. So most of it was not about policy. There were sort of two themes, which I thought were excellent, that did carry through the convention. And one was a unique support of protest, you know, sort of the heralding of protest, which was unique and like I said, I think important. And then there was also a heralding of women as leaders, as policy leaders, as activists, as experts, which is also unique and important. There was not a lot of policy. The two policy moments were when Bernie Sanders laid out what a Biden presidency's policies would be. And then there was a day or the 2 hours that we had of one night that had some serious policy. And there was a chunk of climate policy in that. And I thought that that was generally a good set of policies that were largely focused on green union jobs, focus on renewable energy and returning to Paris. Not a lot of talk specifically of the fossil fuel side, of the keep it in the ground side. And then as you said in your introduction, the DNC platform dropped. So originally did have ending fossil fuel subsidies for the oil and gas industry in the platform. And then that was removed, which was really startling because that's sort of a no-brainer for basically every leading Democratic candidate for president has ending fossil fuel subsidies in his and her platforms, including both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. And as soon as there was attention to the DNC dropping that from their platform, Biden's policy director tweeted out her, Biden's continued support for the ending of fossil fuel subsidies. And then Kamala Harris, who has gone much further on taking on fossil fuels than Biden, the person who had drafted one of Kamala Harris's key policies, or key to me, which was a proposal in her presidential platform, committing herself to pursuing a global negotiation for the managed decline of fossil fuel production worldwide. The person who wrote that policy for Harris then put out a paper detailing what that policy would mean, basically explaining keep it in the ground policy to a broader audience. So I think that those two responses show that the politics that was going on within the Democratic Party platform is not something that is necessarily going to be reflected in the positions of candidates, because, like I said, fossil fuel subsidies is a starting point with most candidates on addressing the climate crisis, not an issue of great debate.
And then any comments on Nancy Pelosi's decision to back Representative Joe Kennedy for Ed Markey's Senate seat? This is somewhat unusual for a centrist establishment Democrat to back a primary challenge to an incumbent, a party incumbent.
Yeah, honestly, when I first saw that come around on Twitter, I thought it was a joke. I completely blew it off and then saw it continue to go through. And then I actually believed it and, you know, dug into the facts on it and saw that it was true. It's quite startling. Markey is someone with who Pelosi has a long political partnership and career. Markey has been a leader on environmental issues, for decades. He's obviously the Senate supporter of the Green New Deal. And, you know, I think this is, Pelosi has been not been a supporter of the Green New Deal and has been, you know, strongly resistant to it for some time. And, you know, I don't think that reflects the broader position of the party on the Green New Deal. There's enormous support for the Green New Deal among Democrats. The last poll I saw was somewhere between 80 and 90% of Democrats. So she is way out of line with the Democratic Party on that position and the people who make up the Democratic Party. And I just think it's an astounding move to have her publicly endorse the other candidate. Mm-hmm. I just think it puts her way out of the norm on what the rest of her party is thinking.
So let's talk about what you wrote in your new piece in Sierra. It's one of a series of pieces that you are getting published this week. And in particular, you talk about how we have a situation right now where the fossil fuel industry is just sitting on these massive reserves. And the first few months of the pandemic showcased just how much of a glut of product that was. In fact, we had you on our program at that time talking about this very thing. Your article is provocatively titled "The End of Oil?" Expand on that. That sounds tantalizing.
Well, I mean, I think just to continue on with the conventions and to frame this, Trump spoke on Monday, opening up the Republican National Convention. And in his speech, he said, Democrats want to take away guns, God, oil, and gas. Hmm. So I think, to frame the Trump's reelection bid, it's God, guns, oil, and gas. And this is a moment where we have a stark difference on what approach is going to be taken to fossil fuels, to continue to support them and subsidize them, and oil in particular, or to aggressively shift away from using these resources. And Trump has made very clear, obviously, his position, as has the Republicans, not only in the rhetoric for this campaign, of course, but in the policies that Trump has and the Republican Congress have implemented during his presidency. And what I lay out in this article is that we are at this moment, the industry is at this unprecedented historical tipping point where we could very well be seeing the end of oil, the beginning of the end of the oil industry right now, depending on what happens with public policy. And so what the COVID-19 pandemic did was expose all of these pre-existing extreme weaknesses within the oil industry and then just make all of them worse. So the industry has been, for many reasons, including collapse in the price of oil that's been happening essentially steadily since 2008. There's been a lot of, a hallmark of oil is volatility, but the trend within that volatility is a decline in the price of oil since 2008, and probably more importantly even than that for the industry, has been a decline in the growth of demand, which has really fallen precipitously, particularly since 2017. But countries and companies that need to make money off of producing oil within that, within a scenario where they're making less for each barrel of oil that they produce, they have to produce more to make the same amount of money. So we've had this, you know, sort of dramatic increase in production at the same time as demand and price and interest in oil is falling. And so we've had this massive glut that was building up well before the COVID-19 pandemic struck. And you also had public will and public policy shift very, very clearly shifting away, except for in the United States, for supporting the industry. And that also was sending a message, as was activism and advocacy and organizing to investors, increasingly seeing oil as unprofitable, as something that didn't have a future. And so money moving away from investing in this industry as well. Then COVID-19 hit and demand cratered and people started not only rejecting further this resource, but looking more aggressively towards what are alternative solutions, alternative policies. And all of this has led to, again, a sort of further retrenching of the industry, producing a product that's less and less attractive and wanted, and still being in this scenario of a glut, which is still happening right now. And that means that there isn't as much money to be made from selling the product. There aren't investors to back them in moving forward with this product, and policies very clearly being enacted now and more seen on the horizon to further constrain demand for and the ability to supply oil. And all of this has this industry that, you know, used to be so dominant and so powerful, and of course still is in certain parts of the world and country, but not anywhere what it used to be.
Antonia, if
facing its the end of its lifespan,
if the U.S. federal government were to stop subsidizing fossil fuels tomorrow, what would happen to the industry at this point, considering where it is in this vulnerable state?
I mean, you know, if it happened immediately and right now, it would be very difficult for large segments of the industry to move forward. So a huge, you've got really two different categories that make up the oil industry. You've got the big multinational oil companies, including many of the state-owned companies, and then you've got sort of everybody else. So in the United States, the U.S. fracking industry has largely been moved forward by smallish independent fracking companies. And those companies have never made a profit. So they've lost about $300 billion over the last decade. They've been propped up by banks, by other investors, other investing actors who are essentially making money off of their debt, making money off of the losses of these companies. And to make money off of that, they continue to subsidize them, to keep them moving, to keep them being sold. And that has just propped up a desperately failing industry, and also government subsidies. So if you removed those subsidies, and if you removed the investment dollars as well, you know, I would say that that whole segment of the industry would have a very, very difficult time of surviving as of tomorrow, as with the larger companies as well.
We are told over and over again that the fossil fuel industry forms the basis of the global economy, that transportation would come to a standstill, that power grids and electrical needs and you know, just the entire economy as it stands would fall apart if the fossil fuel industry were undermined. Is the fossil fuel industry really that integral to the global economy as its proponents claim?
I, you know, Yes, that is absolutely, I mean, there are parts of that that are absolutely true. So the first part is our world remains hardwired to oil. And there are many countries in the world, for example, that are poor nations that still desperately rely on being oil producers. They remain poor, but the money that they get is reliant on being oil producers. The global economy, the global transportation system does still largely run by oil. And that's why we need to implement policies that see that and see that as a problem and move away from that through public policy. So you can't overnight flip a switch that says now there's no more use of oil and gas. You have to implement what is called the managed decline of fossil fuel production, which means those countries and communities that can go first do, and that you have an equity approach to that process, which means that you also look at where are the communities and the countries that are disproportionately bearing the burdens of oil and gas and not the benefits. And so how combining those two approaches to start unwinding oil from the economy while you very aggressively and very rapidly invest and build out the alternatives. Right now, we do have a wealth of alternatives that are in many cases economically superior to fossil fuels. So, you know, wind and solar alternatives that are much more economically advantageous than coal, for example, right now. And the more that we can invest in building out that infrastructure at a localized, sustainable, small-scale system across the world, and change the wealthiest among us, including corporations, figure out how to live healthier and more sustainably by reducing our overall energy consumption, the more rapidly we can shift. And those two pieces need to happen at the same time. How to keep fossil fuels in the ground where they can stay in the ground most rapidly, and then invest in and support the equitable and just transition into the renewable economy. And in so doing, create an alternative set of economic possibilities as well for countries that right now are the most dependent on fossil fuels and subsidize the transition. So, you know, one of the things that is in the Paris Climate Accord is a pledge by the world's governments to support financially the transition of the lowest income countries from, you know, into a renewable green economy. And a key component of that money should also be supporting and helping pay for countries to choose to keep their fossil fuels in the ground. So have rich countries pay poor countries to keep their fossil fuels in the ground and make that transition.
So in other words, Antonio, it's not enough to see the current situation for the fossil fuel industry where it's overwhelmed with a glut of product and falling demand and say that will automatically end the industry, that it really has to be, as you say, this managed decline, that it has to be an industry that is systematically put to bed through very specific and determined policies. So that requires politicians, elected officials to be on board. And you spell out in your article just how that can be done. And I'm wondering then, you know, in light of all of that, do the bailouts that the fossil fuel industry received during the pandemic when the economy was collapsing go in the exact opposite direction that we need them to go? I mean, we saw a lot of industries, the airline industry, which is also, of course, linked to the fossil fuel industry, being bailed out. We saw not nearly enough small businesses getting government-backed loans. But how did the fossil fuel industry benefit off of the pandemic in a way that really runs counter to what needs to happen?
So the Trump administration had initially stated, and Trump himself had stated, that there would be oil and gas industry specific bailouts. And there was enough of a pushback against that, I think particularly by Democrats in Congress, saying that that was a no starter, that didn't happen. And what we got instead was much more stealth support for the industry. So, you know, there's three pockets of money that went to the industry, and this is to the tune of many, many, many billions of dollars. One is through the Paycheck Protection Program. Thousands of oil companies received Paycheck Protection Program money. Then there was, the money that went to the oil and gas industry, by the way, which is almost exclusively a white male run and operated business. And in the United States, most of the workers are also white men who are not contract workers. So you'll see within the oil and gas industry, there is a tremendous use of undocumented labor. But those who are full employees, which obviously get greater benefits and greater pay, are disproportionately white men, and the companies are certainly disproportionately owned, and the executives are disproportionately white men. So in the U.S., the Paycheck Protection Program severely disproportionately benefited white male-owned businesses, and all of the money and all of the companies that and all of the companies that were supported through the Paycheck Protection Program in the oil and gas sector were almost exclusively owned and operated by white men. So the analysis that was done for my article in Sierra Magazine by Documented went through the oil and gas companies that received this money and found just the vast majority were owned and operated by white men. Then there was a tax loophole that was slipped into the act that implemented the Paycheck Protection Program that greatly benefited oil and gas companies who took billions of dollars in write-offs through that loophole. Then there is, through the Federal Reserve, a series of programs put in place through which the U.S. taxpayer is now an owner of oil company debt. We are propping up to the tunes of hundreds of billions of dollars, the market through which corporate debt is being owned and supported through the Federal Reserve. And oil companies are benefiting tremendously from that process, including BlackRock being given essentially the authority to run a good deal of this market. And in markets that it is controlling, oil and gas companies are benefiting tremendously. This new system that was put in place by the Federal Reserve, whereby U.S. taxpayers are direct owners through the Federal Reserve of this corporate debt, is entirely unique. Wow. And is supporting the oil and gas industry. So all of this money certainly has the potential to prop up the industry. It's still not enough, though, to save the industry on its own. It's certainly a valiant effort on the part of Trump and Republicans in Congress, because the Democrats have definitely pushed back on all of these pieces. But it's not enough, because the damage is too great. So I think that, you know, what you've got is an industry that is still, regardless of these bailouts, in serious economic trouble. But whether it's going to be pushed, you know, off of its ability to recover, or if policy continues to support it, it will be able to continue to skate on as it has globally with $5 trillion in government subsidies, you know, operating under just a tremendous support of governments, banks, industry, et cetera. Really depends on the public and on public policy.
Wow. I mean, you mentioned that amount of money, and we're constantly being told there isn't enough money for Medicare for All and for all of the things that human beings actually need. Well, Antonia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article in Sierra that we were discussing earlier from our website. And I know you have a second article coming out, as well as a conversation with Bill McKibben. And I'm sure people can look that up directly as well. Antonia, thanks for all your work and for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Antonia Juhas. She's an energy analyst, investigative journalist, and author specializing in oil politics, and currently a Bertha Fellow in investigative journalism, working with a global team of journalists on fossil fuels and the climate crisis. Her article in Sierra is entitled, "The End of Oil is Near. The Pandemic May Send the Petroleum Industry to Its Grave." I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.